Blog Talk Radio.
Our president, and this week we have Denny Zulu, Gene Tenney, our historian. Good afternoon, Gene.
Good afternoon to you. Thank you for having me.
How are you?
How are you doing? Like everybody else, hunkered down and praying for the best and preparing for the worst. And we, you know, we learned with sadness that one of our friends in California has fallen victim to COVID-19. So, you know, when it starts happening to people, you know, it just takes on another dimension, you know?
Absolutely. So was that person, did they have a pre-existing condition?
Not that I know. I know he had surgeries. I think both he and his wife had fallen victim to it. She seems to have been able to survive, but both of them are in that, you know, that age group of, you know, the boomer generation, and, you know, the one that, but I think I'm even ahead of the boomers. So, you know, we're at extra added risk. And then you've been seeing, I'm sure, the reports as to how African-American deaths are way out of proportion to our percentage of the population in Detroit, in Michigan, in New Orleans, and in other places. So this is definitely something for us to be thinking about, and essentially, I think, you know, being proactive rather than reactive in how we you know, look ahead and what we would, you know, because when this does abate, as it surely will have to, you know, it may not be the last of its kind to come along, but we definitely need to be prepared to do something new and better than what was happening before. And we knew that. I mean, you know, this is starting our next 400 years. You know, last year we observed that 400th anniversary of 1619, when the first captive Africans came into the first English colonies in North America. And, you know, I think a whole lot of us, consciously or subconsciously or even unconsciously, have that resolve that, no, the next 400 years is not that, we're through with that. Too many, that's 20 generations of people. Too many people have been sacrificed to bring us to the nonsense we have now. No, we need a new, as some people would say, a new world order. And, you know, I've long said that, you know, we are the ones that history has forced, obligated, challenged, and blessed to be the truth knowers, truth keepers, and truth tellers. You know, we were excluded from the luxury of having all these fantasies and feel-good myths. So somebody in the population has to keep it real and basically just stand up for life. I mean, you know, the road we were on just does not go any farther. And, either we got to go in a new direction or it's going to be a dead end for the human species. And I, you know, that sounds dramatic, but, you know, there's no guarantee that we, you know, that nature needs us to be here. You know, many other species have gone extinct, and, you know, so it's a time for awakening, and you know, being aware, woke, proactive, creative, compassionate, understanding, accepting, humble, but, you know, standing up, you know. So we'll see what it brings. And I guess it's interesting that we're talking about this because, you know, I often invoke that proverb about how the past is present and the future is now. That, you know, everything that ever happened is still with us. Thing that will ever happen is in us. And what we do with the present moment may not control everything, but certainly will have an influence on what the future will bring. So, you know, and, you know, I guess in bringing that up, I'm really not invoking anything new. I mean, this is just kind of our old traditional wisdom that we had, that even all the slavery, all the lynchings, all the terrorism could not beat that out of us. We still have it. And the time has come for us to step forward and use it, because that's what history is calling upon us to do right now.
Okay, so let me pass this by you. Because, you know, we both understand where we stand as spiritual beings. So this is a mass ascension. People leaving the planet in, mm-hmm. in. So And then you did stipulate that there's no evidence that nature needs us to continue.
Right.
We do understand the plight of human beings on this planet, that particularly the males of the species need to control, need to eliminate other people to feel powerful, need to lord over women and children and other men. Has that seeped in, that paradigm has not worked?
We can only hope. I mean, I think that what you describe is one of several symptoms. I wouldn't say they're the cause, but they're certainly outward symptoms of a very violent dis-ease that our people, our species has had, you know, for a long time. And certainly, you know, that kind of thing, patriarchy and all that idiocy that, you know, and the very idea that one gender would proclaim itself to be more important than another is, I mean, to any sensible person, that is so counterintuitive and illogical. You know, male and female are two halves of the same fruit. I mean, everybody on the planet, every human being, traditional societies, you learn that as a child. There's a reason for there to be, you know, a gender difference, and we live with that in an intelligent way, and each side totally respects the other, and then, you know, there's no other sensible way to live. When you start hearing about or seeing all this idiocy, I mean, that you know, I'm male, I consider myself as much man as anybody, but am I supposed to subscribe to that kind of just what is it? Psychopathology is what it is, you know. But it's you know, it's the old story. It's you know, when the love of power overcomes the power of love, that's what you get. I mean, and so the question is, well, why? What is it that seduces people into the love of power? And then, you know, you think that's something that the human race has gone through for a long time. You go all the way back to ancient Kemet and the legend of Osiris and his insanely jealous brother, you know, Set, who, you know, Osiris is the creator. He represents the oneness of the universe. You know, his brother doesn't get it. He's envious. Well, why he got that and not me? As if, you know, he has no concept of, well, you know, he has that and you have what you have.
But the thing is that having comes from within. So if you're looking at it that, you know, and you know, this is not what our discussion is supposed to be about today. It's supposed
but
to
it's
be
a good way to introduce
Asala.
It.
Yes,
but it's a good intro. It's a good intro.
Yes. So let's talk about how you first came to Asala.
Ooh, how I first came to it. Well, let's see. This would have been 1971, perhaps. Maybe 72. I think it was 71. Then it was ASNLH still, Association for the Study of Negro Life and History. Their convention was at the Americana Hotel in New York. I was living in Boston. I went there and heard John Henry Clark speak. And that was my introduction to it, to the organization. And certainly, I mean, I think we'll agree, I could hardly have had a better introduction to it than hearing John Henry Clark, because he was one who was so close in spirit to Dr. Woodson, you know, who founded the organization. I think of Dr. Clark, how many times he called for, you know, we need an army of scholars, you know, not an army with weapons and destruction, but an army that's dedicated to knowledge and the quest for truth. And so, you know, having had that introduction, I think it was, well, many years later that I attended again. I couldn't even tell you where it was, but it might have been Washington or Baltimore. Over the years, and especially after, you know, I came to Miami, and one of the kind of early, I would almost call it assignments that I was given, because I was made aware of the fact that historically there was actually a set of plans of a slave ship, design plans that actually survived, and that with that, this could be replicated and we could tell our story. And so that kind of gave me a an interest in history that I may not, you know, otherwise have had, because, you know, my whole goal in coming here was that I was going to try the absurd proposition of surviving as an artist, which has actually sort of worked out. But it was kind of clear that I could not do that without having to really get an understanding of history and, you know, how we got here. I can even back up and make another point about that, which was when I began visiting the South, I realized that to really understand the history of this country, it's impossible without understanding the South. And I knew that I would have to spend some time in the South. Now, at the time, I thought that might have been North Carolina or South Carolina or Georgia. I did not anticipate that I would go so far south as Miami, which is almost like flying over the whole South. But as we all know, Miami is southern enough to, give us some awareness of, what this was. And I think the important awareness is not so much, you know, we think of the South and the whole history of just madness and oppression and segregation and discrimination and all of this, but the real story of the South is what was the Native indigenous response to this? What was the African response to this? And I even use the term response, you know, advisedly, because I'm, you know, I still say we should be think proactively. So what did African people do to affirm, assert, continue celebrating their humanity and ours in such a way that, in spite of all of that, they could still give life to future generations and give wisdom to future generations? And so that kind of broad agenda would have underscored my interest in the South. Then, you know, having embraced this whole project of building a slave ship that could be a traveling international museum and an educational resource center and an ancestral memorial shrine. And I had a brother from Delaware who had a very similar vision. He didn't have the same specific plans, and he's kind of joined me on that. And we've been working on that for quite some time now. In fact, some sense, shamefully long time for it not to have been done.
Are you talking about building an actual ship?
Yes. Yes. And before this year is out, we'll be reminded that this is the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower arriving in Massachusetts. That ship has been replicated. The Viking ships have been replicated. Columbus ships have been replicated. The Jamestown ships have been replicated. The Dove, which brought the first English settlers to Maryland, has been replicated, and is being replicated again. The Calhoun Nickel that brought the first Scandinavian settlers to Delaware has been replicated. So the list goes on. So the point that comes with that is, when we think of what those replicated historic ships do, where you actually get a chance to step aboard and have the 3D experience of what must it have been like for the people who made this voyage, it is a far more compelling teaching tool, if you will, than even the best of books, movies, pictures, and so forth. So that specific project gave me another reason to take a greater interest in Asala, and to go to meetings and make presentations and so forth. And then that in turn was followed by historic preservation.
Let me stop for a minute. So Asala means the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. Just for those who are listening, you may not know. So now, as the historian for Asala, South Florida, what in the 3 years have you, that we've been in existence, because we're new, what would you say that we have accomplished historically?
I would say, and I mean, and this might sound just a little bit glib, but I think just the fact of establishing a chapter was kind of a historic accomplishment in itself. And I say that because it has created a platform for us to come together and by the way, I'd be remiss because I made a point of wanting to share with the listeners that this having this interview is even more of an honor, because I'm kind of talking to the spirit mother of this whole effort to establish a South Florida branch, and having an official branch, and thank you for kind of clarifying for the listeners, what Asala is, ASALH, and so forth. And, I think it's worth just pausing to describe that, it's an organization that has individual members all over the country, some who are lifetime members, but some of those cities have actually formed branches, which is a little more of an elevated status within the organization. And what those branches are able to do is to bring local history to the national stage that otherwise would not get there, and always in a way that proves to be beneficial. I've been working, for example, for a number of years, even before our branch got started, with the Memphis branch, because that branch has been engaged in memorializing the Fort Pillow Massacre, which took in along the Mississippi River, about 40 miles north of Memphis. And some of the people who did survive were and are buried in the National Cemetery in Memphis. And that branch's role in their ability to bring Memphis history to the table, of which there is so much. I mean, from, I mentioned the Fort Pillow Massacre. You have the Memphis, the massacres of 1866.
Okay, but let's stick with our chapter, okay?
Yeah, I use that as an example.
I understand. However, you have the Loxahatchee event, and you have the Key West event, and you have the Virginia
That's what I was coming
Key
to.
Event. So,
thank
you. I don't want to, we only have 5 minutes left. So talk about our event. Okay.
Right, and I was using that as the introduction to precisely that South Florida has so much unique history, and you mentioned some of it. And I'll just take them, just as you mentioned them. One is Loxahatchee is in the northern end of Palm Beach County, Jupiter. That is the site of the battlefield where the two pivotal battles in what the U.S. government called the Seminole Wars, for the Seminoles, who were basically not a tribe, but a people, a gathering of African-American and Native people, African-Americans who liberated themselves from slavery, Native people who were able to escape from settler encroachment into Florida. They were able to make Florida into freedom land while it was Spanish territory. And so the whole narrative of the quest for freedom in Florida is one that is unique and deserving of more attention and knowledge. And that's one that we as a branch will be looking at more. Historic preservation projects. You mentioned Virginia Key Beach. That was the colored beach in Miami-Dade County. Unlike other colored parks in the Jim Crow South, this one was, it had amenities, amusement rides, concessions, and things that were unheard of at colored parks in the South. And it became sort of nationally known, and Dr. Martin Luther King came there. And so there's a lot of history embodied there, including the history of all of the local neighborhoods and social classes for a very wide radius, and spiritual history, the number of people who were baptized there and so forth. And of course, there's environmental and natural history as well, which, a lot of, propaganda would have us to believe that this is not something that interests our people. But I mean, we know better that, I mean, our knowledge of nature is part of what made us so valuable as an enslaved workforce that was so highly coveted. Key West is the site of the African Cemetery, where in 1863, American-owned slave ships that were bound for Cuba were captured, and the rescue people were brought to the nearest port, which was Key West. They were housed there for 12 weeks. President Buchanan decided that they should be returned to Africa. They weren't going to get back to their homelands, but they would be sent to Liberia. And during that time, out of the 1,234 people who had been rescued, 295 of them died from just all of what they had endured while at sea. And they're buried in Key West. And that was a story that sort of got forgotten until the mid-90s when it got revived. And much more work has been done. So now we've done ground-penetrating radar to locate where all the burials are, all the known burials. We think some are still under the pavement and so forth. But the street will be relocated. And so that story is one of several connections to Middle Passage or slave trade history that Key West has. The Nell Fisher Museum down there has been a very active player in displaying and conserving artifacts and archival knowledge. There's a fascinating story. I would ask anybody to just Google it for themselves, Sandy Cornish, S-A-N-D-Y-C-O-R-N-I-S-H, who was born into slavery in Maryland and ended up as one of Key West's most prominent citizens by way of he did a spectacular self-mutilation and to make himself unvaluable as a slave when his free papers burned up and people tried to recapture him and sell him to slavery. I mean, that's the kind of price of freedom people had to pay. Those stories
Gene,
are alive and well in Key West. Mm-hmm.
Gene.
Yes.
I think we're going to have you back again.
How much time we have left?
Because we're at the end of the show. So,
oh my God!
I'm
okay,
set up the
so
show.
I will be less loquacious the next time, and more
no, you
on
won't.
On
that
on
won't
point.
Happen. That won't happen. We love your loquaciousness. So thank you very much. I'm sure that people will listen to this, some comments, and we'll be back in touch with you to come back on next month. How about that?
All right. I look forward to that, and listen, keep up all the good that you're doing, and continue to do, and you know, everybody out there, stay safe, please take this seriously, and let's think about our own plans for when this is over.
Okay, thank you, talk
all
to
right.
you soon.
Okay.
Peace.
We'll talk soon.
So
take
everybody,
care. Bye-bye.
SavalaSouthFlorida.wordpress.com. Talk to you next time. This is Dr. Joan Cartwright.